I remember there was a movie or something where the one of the lines was it was a rule in this couple, this married couple, that only one of them could be crazy at a time. It's like that. Y'all should have that rule in your relationships. Only one of you can be crazy. And the other thing was that my four-year-old calls waterfalls wonderfuls. That was what he was referring to. And it's just, isn't that great? We all need to be 4 years old. That's it. In fact, I think that's exactly what Jesus said. Hey, before you go, Daryl, everybody take a look at Daryl's legs and feet. See? He was afraid that he wasn't properly attired to do the announcements today. But we quickly dissuaded him of that. But even more important, he's kind of my object lesson, because what I want to talk about this morning is washing feet. And we just came off of Holy Week here last week, and Holy Thursday, Maundy Thursday, as it's called in the liturgy of the church, celebrates and commemorates the Last Supper and all the events during the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden, where'd that come from? Garden of Gethsemane. Let's try that. A little bit of difference there. And during that Last Supper, Jesus did several things. He instituted communion, obviously. He gave the new commandment, the mandatum novum in Latin, where Maundy Thursday gets its name, actually, which was to love each other as I have loved you. But the other thing that he did that evening was to wash his disciples' feet. And this is a real celebrated event in the Gospels, and everybody knows about it pretty much. And it has spawned all sorts of talk about servant leadership and what that means in a social justice sort of context. But what I want to do this morning is to talk about the washing of the feet in terms of its application to our lives. I want to see what is it saying about our lives right here and right now, and take a little bit different take on it as usual in here. And if you think about the theme of what we were talking about last Sunday, we were talking about what does it take to actually see the risen Lord? Because everyone who saw him for the first time didn't recognize him in the Gospels. You remember that? Mary at the garden outside the tomb sees him, thinks he's the gardener, and the two walking toward Emmaus, they have a conversation for 7 miles with him and half a meal before they recognize who he is. And Peter and James and John in the boat see him on the shore. They don't recognize him. And so all of this non-recognition has to do with the belief system that we adhere to, the belief system that we believe in, our expectations that keep us from seeing what's right in front of our eyes, keep us from seeing what Jesus is trying to show us. And this story of the washing of the feet falls right into that category. Jesus washing feet was something that his disciples could not accept. Let's read a little bit of the story, and it's in your handouts there. And that'll get us started at John 13:3-9. Just to set the tone of it. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And so he came to Simon Peter, and he said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said to him, What I do you do not realize now, but you will understand hereafter. And Peter said to him, Never shall you wash my feet. And Jesus answered him, If I do not wash you, you have no part with me. And Simon Peter said to him, Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. You know, you just have to love Peter, don't you? Isn't it amazing? In the spare way that the Gospels relate any story, I mean, they use so few words, they use so few descriptions. And after 2,000 years of interpretation and copying and translation, his personality still rings through. That's incredible. Everything he does was gregarious and spontaneous and kind of over the top, you know. Here he is stepping out of boats and swimming to shore and just doing the craziest things. But you just gotta love him. But what you also have to do is understand he didn't get it. He didn't understand what Jesus was all about. Even at this point where he'd been with him several years, you know, traveling everywhere throughout Judea and the Galilee and eating with him and sleeping with him and doing all the things that they did together out as they're camping in the wilderness, and all the teaching that he went through, all the signs that he saw, all the parables and stories that he heard. And when it comes to this, he still doesn't get it. Because, especially after that triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, where everyone is treating Jesus in the prophetic way of the Messiah, the King, who is going to set up the new kingdom, the reformed kingdom of David that was going to put Israel back on the map as a sovereign nation, that was going to kick out the Romans and reestablish themselves as their own country. How in the world could he see Jesus in the guise of a servant washing feet? He couldn't compute it. It didn't work. And it wasn't just him. It was all of them. But before we go into some examples of how they didn't get it, I just want to set the stage a little bit with you, because we culturally don't understand what this foot washing was all about. And the first thing to get the foot washing is you got to understand how they actually had supper. You know, Da Vinci did us no favors when he depicted the Last Supper the way he did. You know, a straight table with everybody sitting up, you know, kind of side by side, and we're having this. I guess it worked for artistic composition, but in terms of accuracy, it was woefully inadequate. Because in the ancient East, and especially in Israel, people didn't sit at table, they reclined at table. And so what you would typically have in a supper setup is you would have three tables set up, you know, at right angles in a horseshoe type of configuration. So it's open at one end so that servers could come through and serve from the front. And then you had cushions that were set up on the outside of the table. And each cushion could, you know, seat maybe or lie three people, you know. And what they would do is they would lie at right angles to the table on their left side, kind of prop themselves up with their left arm and elbow, and then they would eat with their right hand. And then you would have people behind you or in front of you, depending on where you were at table, sort of in a spooning kind of configuration where everybody was, your back was facing the person behind you and your back was facing the person behind him and her and so on and so forth. And so if the person in front of you who had their back to you and was coming up against your chest, that was the person who was understood to be in your bosom. And so when you hear the Gospels talk about John, the disciple that Jesus loved, being in Jesus' bosom, you know, we picture him Da Vinci-ish, you know, sitting together and laying his head against Jesus' chest. But actually all it meant was he was the one to Jesus' immediate right. Now, he might have laid his head back on Jesus' chest when he was talking to him or whatever, but that's what that means. And when we hear that one interesting story about the poor man Lazarus who dies and the rich man dies, and the rich man sees across the gulf the poor man Lazarus lying in Abraham's bosom. And again, we think of him like crawled up in his lap or something. But what it means is this seating arrangement at table, where Lazarus was to the right of Abraham, the right being the favored side. And there's a lot about right and left hands and right and left in the ancient culture that has survived to this day as well. Because the left hand was considered unclean. The left hand was considered the hand that could shame. And so in ancient culture, the hand itself was a symbol of power or authority, or even custody. But the left hand had the power to shame. It was the hand that was misfortunate, the hand that was unlucky, the hand that brought those things. And the right hand was the hand that brought power and authority and righteousness. And so you never ate with your left hand anyway, which is the reason you laid on your left side. And all the food was finger food. It was all prepared so you could eat it with one hand. Typically, it was breads that were dipped in various sauces, or the bread was used to pick up pieces of meat or other parts of the meal. But you ate with one hand, and there were no utensils, right? It's all finger food, which was why washing your hands before a meal was so important, because you ate with your fingers. And so this is the kind of setup that you have. And so the feet were exposed because they were sticking out in the back. And typically, a master's servant would have a towel wrapped around his waist and would stand in waiting at his master's feet behind the table if anything was needed. And as the meal went on, the servers were coming in from the front and they were being attended to from the back. And this was the setup that we have there. You know, being a left-hander myself, it's hard not to get a little bit insulted about where this left-hand, right-hand thing goes. But it's fascinating because all of that has carried forward to the present day. You know, our words out of Latin, in Latin the word for left is sinistra. It's the word that we use to get our word sinister. And so, you know, left has come down to us as evil, as misfortune, you know, as all these calamitous sort of things. And conversely, in Latin, the word for right is dexter. It's the word we get dexterity from. It meant skilled, skillful, you know, and all the positive things. And so we got this right hand, left hand thing going. You know, the left hand was seen as unclean, but even more unclean than the left hand were the feet. And why not? Think about it. In a culture where the primary mode of transportation is walking, where the primary roads are all unpaved, they're all dirt, and you're walking miles between different towns or whatnot, your feet could get really dirty because the primary footwear was an open-toed sandal. Basically just a piece of wood or leather that was the sole and to which thongs were attached, and you just tied them to your feet. And so you could get pretty dirty walking. Now, this idea of foot washing goes back thousands of years. We see it in stories of Abraham back in the Old Testament. But the idea was is that it wasn't done between members of the family unless one of the family members went on a journey. But it was always done for visiting guests who had traveled. And it was typical for the host of the house to greet a visiting traveler or a friend or even a stranger to his home by taking him, giving him a ceremonial kiss, and maybe anointing his head with oil, and then allowing the servant to wash the feet. But the washing the feet was the really disgusting part. I mean, you got to think about it. You're walking, you're sweating, the dirt is caking on your foot, between your toes, all these things. The washing of the feet was the most disgusting thing that was done within the household as they understood it. And so it was reserved for the lowest rank of slave or servant. Even Jewish slaves weren't obligated to wash feet, if you can believe that. So it was really, really low. Typically, wives did it for their husbands. Sometimes the children did it for their husbands when they came home. But it was always done from an inferior to a superior, and never the other way around. And it was really regarded as disgusting, unclean work. So the shoes themselves, the sandals, all of these things were considered to be unclean. Interestingly enough, disciples of a master were required to wash the master's feet when necessary or could do so, but they weren't required to unloosen the sandal straps of the feet. And that's interesting too, because John the Baptist tells us that he wasn't even worthy to unloosen Jesus' sandal straps, which is putting him in the lowest of the low. See, all of these things start to take on meaning when we understand from a cultural point of view. I mean, even today in Arab, remember in Arabic culture, remember when that Arab threw his shoe at President Bush? Because the shoe itself was considered unclean. The worst insult you could give would be to slap someone across the face with your sandal, with that unclean thing. You know? So this is transferred down through Semitic culture and into Arabic culture. So when Saddam's statue came down and they were pounding it with their shoes, this was the ultimate insult in that culture. This is where it comes from. This is the understanding. And I want you to get that because it's so important to understand the impact that this would have had on the followers of Jesus who had just hailed him as king, were praying for him and starting to believe in him as Messiah, you know, as the one who came not only in the name of the Lord, but in the power and the might of David. And he stands up at table before the meal is served and takes off his outer garments. It doesn't mean that he was naked. It means that there were several pieces of Hebrew clothing that he removed. Typically, Hebrew males wore a loincloth. Over that, there was an inner tunic, which was kind of like a long-sleeved t-shirt that hung to the knees or sometimes to the ankles. And they had a girdle about that that was about 6 or 9 inches wide that acted like a pouch, a pocket, or even a fanny pack kind of thing. They could put things in it, maybe a money belt sort of deal. They also stuck their knife or their sword in there for protection. So it was an important article of clothing. Over that was an outer tunic, kind of like a bathrobe. You know, it was open in front, long sleeves again, hung to the knees or to the mid-calf. And over that was the mantle, a big square piece of wool. That was also their prayer shawl. Those outer garments are what Jesus took off. He took off the mantle. He took off the outer tunic. He took off the girdle. And then he ties a towel or a piece of linen around his waist. And you got to figure that the disciples are just thinking, what in the world is he doing? And then when he walks to the back of the table, brings a bowl of water and starts washing their feet, they must have just been freaking out. But the only one with the whatever to be able to say anything about it, I'm not going to say the word in here, is Peter. He does it. You know, you're going to wash my feet? Lord, never. And Jesus' response is cryptic, but it's classic. If I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And Peter doesn't get it any more than he did a moment before, but he says, as long as you say that, then wash my head and everything else. You know? It's very telling that Jesus is trying to get Peter to see something that he can't see at the moment. You know? If you cannot see this, if you cannot understand this, if you cannot go with me here, you can have no part with me. Now, often the church has looked at this from the point of view that if the sins of Peter were not cleansed by Jesus, either in the ceremonial washing or by the blood covering from the cross, there was no way that he was going to be saved in the sense of going to heaven ultimately. But I want to turn that around, and I want you to consider that what Jesus was talking about is that if you can't understand what I'm doing, then you have no idea what my mission and my ministry and my whole life force is all about. If you really think that I came here to throw out the Romans, if you really think that I came here to be a political figure, how can you possibly have a part of what I'm about? You have to get this, Peter. You have to understand. But it wasn't just Peter who misunderstood. Take a look at Matthew 18, 1-4, right here. This goes back a little bit further, like a flashback. And at that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" See, they were fighting. They were always fighting. They were always jockeying for position. Because in their view, they were the ones who were there at the beginning. They were the ones who had paid their dues. They were the ones who helped Jesus along when he was nobody. And now when he's going to come into his kingdom, where is the reward? Who gets to sit at the right hand? Who gets the best seats at table? Who's the greatest in the kingdom? These were the things that they were wondering about. And if you look at, I just gave you three examples here, but in parentheses after it are the parallel passages. And there are other passages. When you read the Gospels, you see the disciples constantly fighting over these things because they didn't understand what Jesus was about. Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And he called the child to himself and set him before them. He calls a child who was property in that culture, who is nothing socially in that culture. And he said, "Truly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And then in Luke 22, they're asking the same question. Who is the greatest in the kingdom? And the answer is pretty much the same too. He says, "The one who is the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves." And in Matthew 20, the same answer. "Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee," that's James and John, "came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, 'What do you wish?' And she said, 'Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and one on your left.'" They even sent their mother to ask Jesus for the favor. And the answer he gave was the same as in Luke 22. "You don't understand. You just don't understand what I'm really trying to say to you right now." Jesus was portraying himself as the servant. He was trying to get them to make this incredible worldview shift. First of all, to see his kingdom as not of this world. They were seeing it continuously as a kingdom of this world, something that they understood. They understood the rules to it. He was trying to get them to see something different. And he was also trying to get them to see him as something different. He was trying to just completely turn their world upside down. And in Luke 14, it's not in your bulletins there, but just listen. "He began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table." Get it? He comes to a meal at someone's home and everybody is jockeying and trying to get the places, the best places. You know, the best places would have been in that middle table on the right-hand side. That would have been the best place. And it goes down from there and around, right? So they're all jockeying for this position. And he says to them, "When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. For someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him, and he who invited you both will come to you and say, 'Give your place to this man.' And then in disgrace you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. He's trying to take our understanding of how things work in this life and turn it on its head. When you think about it, the model for all of human organization is basically what? It's a pyramid, right? You got the leader at the top, or you got a small group of people with power, prestige, money, influence, whatever at the top, and everyone underneath in successive widening tiers supports them, serves them all the way down to the bottom. It's the model for government, it's the model for empire, it's the model for corporations, it's the model for the church. It's the model that's been used since the very beginning. And it's really sad to say that the church has used the same model. Except for a brief period where the church was just home fellowships in people's houses, where it was basically voluntary communism, where everyone came and had a meal during the week and threw everything on the table and divvied it up among each other. At the point that it grew, bishops, episcopos, overseers had to be established in order to oversee. And then the overseers from the large cities like Rome and Constantinople saw themselves as being reigning over the episcopos, the bishops in the smaller cities. And eventually the church became modeled after the Roman Empire, after a military model. If you think of the Vatican, you've got the Pope. Under him, you've got the Council of Cardinals. Under that, you've got priests and bishops of various ranks down to the lowly parish priest. And under him are the laity and the deacons and the other helpers. And under that are just the parishioners themselves. It's the pyramid. It's the basic structure of everything. And we forget, who is it that's being served? And who is it that's serving? All of us have this same model in our minds. The Pharisees certainly had this model in their minds. They were using their religious authority for their own personal gain. And Jesus came into conflict with them time and time again because he saw them as the worst perpetrators, because they were taking the trust of the people. They were taking the people's longing for God and standing squarely between them and God, making them climb over them and through the rules that they established in order to get to God. And Jesus had harsh things to say to them. Take a look in Matthew 23. He says, they, the Pharisees, love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. You know that line, do not call anyone on earth your father, has been used often to malign the Catholic Church because they call priest fathers. But Jesus had a much broader meaning. He was telling the people, don't let anyone get between you and God. Don't abdicate your spiritual journey, your experience of the living God to somebody else. Not to clergy, not to me, not to anybody. It's your journey. It's your relationship. It's your experience. Jesus was trying to connect the people back to their Father and let nothing stand in between. This is where he's going with all of this. And then he's telling the Pharisees, you have completely corrupted your position. You are now being served instead of serving the people that are here, that need you and need to be connected with their Father. Call no man Father. I love that. There is a business model that I read about. I think it was way back in the early 90s. And it took the idea of the pyramid and changed it completely. And what it was a circle, all right? In the very center of the circle, the prime place, guess who was there? CEO, board of directors, chairman of the board. No, you know who was in the prime spot in the center of the circle? It was the customer, the client. That was the person in the center. And then in concentric rings moving out, radiating out from the client or the customer in descending levels of importance, I guess you could say, Guess what the next ring was next to the client? It was your customer service rep. It was your tech support rep. It was your waitress if you were in the restaurant business. It was whoever had direct contact with the customer. Why? Because I don't care how big your company is. I don't care how great your logo is. I don't care how marvelous your management team is. Your company is only as good as the person I'm talking to right now. You know? I'm having trouble with my email for Chili Americas, our nonprofit. So I call this company, huge company, and right on the phone as I'm listening, waiting on hold, they're saying, "We are a 3-time Deloitte and Touche honoree, and we won this award and that award, and the customer comes first." And then I'm waiting for 20 minutes to talk to the person. And then when I get the person, it's obvious they don't want to talk to me. They just want to get me off the phone and do the next thing they want to do. What's my opinion of this company? You see? You know, when I was in that position working for the phone company, I was one of those tech support guys, you know, telephone, what was it, 611, telephone repair. And I didn't want to be there. You know, I was in my early 20s, and I didn't want to be there. I was always getting in trouble because I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do with the client, the customer. I didn't understand this concept. I wasn't taking them seriously. I wasn't realizing that the only reason I got paid is because people like that called in to talk to me. And I wasn't taking it seriously. This business model is wonderful because it puts the client, the reason for existence of any company is the customer first. And then the people that deal with the customer first. And supporting them are their supervisors. And supporting them are their managers. And supporting them are whatever, upper management, vice presidents. And finally, on the outer edges of the circle, are the CEO and the COO. And then outside of them is a board of directors and the chairman of the board. All with the idea that those people are all supporting everyone down the chain of command. Empowering them. Making their lives easier. Making them love their job and helping them to do their job well so that eventually the person who is ultimately being served is the one who's paying all the bills. Makes perfect sense. You know, if you want to think of it in terms of the pyramid, turn that pyramid upside down. And so that everyone starting from the power center, what we normally see as a power center, is supporting everyone up. That's what Jesus is trying to get us. But you know what? It's not just about org charts. You know, it's about really changing the way that you look at life. And we're not immune. Every single one of us in here. What do you gravitate toward as being a person of power or a leader? What are the icons? What are the symbols? What are the things that we naturally see? The person who steps out of the stretch limo onto the red carpet with all that constant flickering and flashing of cameras, with the bodyguards with the little curly cues sticking out of their ears and all of that pomp and circumstance, that is a person who gets our attention, takes our breath away, gets noticed. That's a person of power. How about the guy with the broom who sweeps up after the entourage has moved on? We don't even see that person. Now, it's not that that person has virtue just because they're carrying a broom, but it means if we are the type of people that only gravitate toward those who have the trappings of wealth and power or talent or whatever it may be, we have no part with Jesus. We do not understand what he's talking about. We would not let him wash our feet because we don't understand why he's doing it. But most importantly, we wouldn't be the ones who would wash feet. We wouldn't be the ones who would see this. It's so important for us to understand what Jesus is saying. Finally, in John 13, when it comes around, after Peter has said, "Wash my hands and my head and everything else," and Jesus said, "So when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined back at the table, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done to you? Do you call me teacher and Lord? And you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should also do as I did to you.'" But this is more than an example, and it's more than a request, but it's less than a commandment. All right? What it really is a prerequisite. If we can't see what Jesus is talking about, if we can't change our attitude toward life and to the others around us, it's not that we're going to be excluded from the kingdom. We won't even see it. It won't be present or possible for us if we can't make this code shift, this switch in thinking. If we can't become like children, we can't enter the kingdom. Not because nobody's letting us, but because we'll walk right past it. We won't value it. Jesus said, you know, whatever you do to the least of these, you do to me. If we can't see Jesus in the least of these, we would walk right past him himself if he was present to us right now. Because we'd be looking for the guy in the stretch limo. We'd be looking for the guy with the guards around him at the head of the army. We'd be looking for the guy who's going to march in on the white steed and change our circumstances, kick out the Romans in our lives. That's who we're looking for. We will miss him when he comes riding the donkey. When he comes in the guise of the person bleeding in the gutter that the Samaritan helped. If we can't make this shift, we can't see kingdom. And we have no part with Jesus. But I want to take you one more step further than that. Jesus said that he and the Father were one. He said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. All right. Our God, the creator of the universe, the Alpha and the Omega, the one who spans the universe with one handbreadth, is the God who will wash our feet, is the God who serves us. Sound like blasphemy to you? Probably does. It's hard to get your head wrapped around something like that. Our God will wash our feet. Our God serves us. Our God loves us that much. Our Father is kingdom. Our Father is love, is forgiveness, is deliverance, is salvation. That's who and what he is. Right down to the periodic table of the elements. Cut as deep as you want. You won't find anything else. It's what he is. He is kingdom. That means he is Talia, the word that Jesus used that means child and also house servant. And he said, if you can't convert and become Talia, you can't enter kingdom. Our Father in heaven is Talia. Our Father is oneness in thought and deed. If you've seen Jesus, you've seen the Father. If you've seen love, you've seen the Father. It's all one. It's the same thing. Our Father is oneness, and he certainly doesn't ask us to do anything different than he isn't already doing himself. There is complete integrity here. And Jesus said, these things you see me do, you can do, and greater things. We can do this too, but we have to understand. You know, we love because he first loved us. We can do these things because he first did them. He created us, but he serves us. Until we can see who God is and accept that God for what he is, and to start to see life through his eyes, through that lens, we can't have any part with him, and we can't enter kingdom. This is what Jesus is trying to tell us. Let's pray. Father, your word is so simple and so difficult at the same time. But it's only difficult to the extent that we hang on to our old belief systems and our expectations, the ambitions, I suppose, the hopes and dreams of the things that we want to accomplish. Help us to be willing to let go of all of these things in favor of what really is, because what really is so incredibly, amazingly, unconditionally in our favor that we could never imagine what it is that you have for us. So much better than anything that we can try to get for ourselves. Help us to see bit by bit what you mean in a simple action of washing feet. that can change our entire worlds, the way we look at life, the way we see people and ourselves. Help us to become more and more like you, Lord, more and more like your Son. We want to be him. We want to emulate him. We want to love the way he loved so that we can understand the way that we are loved. And we thank you for everything that you've given us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.